as we have already pointed out, our case is built very largely upon circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence has a validity, particularly when a number of different evidential points all lead in the same direction, or all indicate the same general trend. But nearly always, any reasonable idea which a human being can hold can be assailed by another person who does not accept it as reasonable. Thus, acceptance of the reasonable is not assured, and many persons will not acknowledge even factual evidence if it is contrary to their own inclinations. It is more difficult, however, to deny a fact than it is to deny a reasonable assumption. Thus, we are still working constantly in our own minds to clarify in as reasonable a way as possible all of the elements of this story, so that we may come to conclusions and may be able to say with good semantics, I believe that this is reasonable, and I am inclined to accept it. I accept it because it is reasonable, not because it is factual. And we'll continue to search for additional reasonable points, and hope always that in the course of seeking, facts themselves shall be revealed. We will take an example of our problem this evening. To start with, we're dealing with some European aspects of the matter. So let us take one of the most interesting and confusing problems that we have in the field of Atlantis research. And that is the effort to explain the migrations of the lemmings. Now, the lemmings are a small rodent-like animal, about 5 inches in length, very similar to the American field mouse. The lemmings inhabit northern areas of Western Europe. And normally, they are like our field mice, rather difficult to find and not apparently over plentiful. But periodically, they increase tremendously in number. And on an average of from 4 to 7 years. This figure is not irregular. We have migrations of lemmings. Migrations that are a little reminiscent of the story of the bird migrations at our mission of San Juan Capistrano. The lemmings suddenly increase tremendously in number. And they begin to move downward into Norway and Sweden, and they become a very serious problem. They can be counted and numbered in millions. Why they should so suddenly increase is not as yet understood. Again, we have only reasonable findings, even on a scientific level. But these creatures, moving over vast areas of land, impoverish it because of their constant need of food, and they are accompanied by birds, animals that prey upon them, so that often there is a great slaughter of lemmings as they continue this migratory course. It seems that these creatures move by a mass motion. They move with a complete purpose, a purpose for which we have no answer or solution at this time. Their general tendency is to descend from higher levels through valleys or through breaks of the land, always moving downward toward sea level. The lemmings also will swim rivers, swim lakes several miles across, and continue on their way undisturbed and uninterrupted. They multiply very rapidly, and in the course of their migration, which may take anywhere from 1 to 3 years, the number of lemmings at the end of this perilous trip is often greater than at the beginning. Inevitably, the lemmings move toward water, large bodies of water, most frequently the Atlantic Ocean. And when they reach the shore of the Atlantic, they swim out into the ocean and continue to swim until they drown. No one knows why. At the end of the migration, it is not known that any of them ever turn back. They all, apparently, go forth together into a collective suicide. Now, this migration of the lemmings has been the cause of considerable speculation. So we can start, of course, with folklore. The natives of the area have an idea that these tremendous increases in the number of lemmings are the result of these creatures falling from the sky. There's an ancient belief that they rain down upon the earth at certain times. Also, it is held in the local areas, even now, by some of the more learned and intelligent members of the communities, that the lemmings are following an ancient trade route, that they are going according to a way they have always gone, and that their original purpose was to reach an area of land now submerged. And it has been pointed out, even in scientific papers, that their general route coincides with land area that has been submerged. Apparently, the lemmings are continuing to seek a place in the ocean beyond the shore. And although this place has disappeared, vanished forever, the instinct of this rodent continues unchanged. If this be a reasonable hypothesis, and it has even been accepted scientifically, it means the lemmings are attempting to convey to us in a strange way through the drama and tragedy of their lives that once upon a time they could reach land which is no longer there. That this land must have at one time been of unusual attraction to them. That they are continually seeking for it. And year after year they die trying to find it. Now, what is behind all of this? Is it merely that these creatures are pressed on by some suicidal tendency? Do they go in nature merely to die? What does this instinct mean? Does it really tell us that there is a power, a driving force behind this species of creatures that will not change or has not changed, but continues to send them on their way to death? Nature normally does not produce circumstances of this kind. Nature is forever adjusting for the survival of its creatures. Why then do millions of the lemmings swim forth into the ocean to die? Experience has shown that they did not have to do so. They could have turned back. Even though their migration is heavy, it is not of the type of a herd of thundering buffaloes. They are not forced by the back pressure of their own kind to drown. Any kind they could stop. Any one of them could have survived the entire catastrophe, but no, not one of them does. Well, here's the answer. This has been advanced as indicated. The migration of creatures, otherwise to be noted, where a distribution shows that at some remote time, there must have been land bridges between continents now completely divided. That these land bridges resulted in the general diffusion of creatures. These creatures change somewhat, but not necessarily totally. It is assumed, therefore, that the lemmings are following an ancient route that was a land route at the time of the Miocene period. That they have never been able to overcome the instinct to follow an old order of the Earth's arrangement. And perhaps the reason why they have continued is because they have no means of common communication. Not one can come back and tell the others. Therefore, each discovers only by dying. It is a strange and remarkable story, but it's one of the facts that tells us, apparently, that these creatures have always expected to find land, that they did not expect to die. So the instinct that drives them may be of psychological importance. We have no way of knowing whether the lemmings have the folk consciousness on a lower level that we recognize in certain human culture groups. In any event, their strange little pattern, locked within their own primitive structure, is this seeking of another land beyond the water. We know that they have not been influenced by Ignatius Donnelly or anyone else. They are not seeking because of eternal churchward or because of any modern writer. They have not even perused the Timaeus and previous to Plato. They are merely obeying something, obeying a force that is irresistible. The same force that probably at one time did permit them to wander into other regions and perhaps ultimately breed into what we call the American field mouse. Whatever it was, this is another natural relic which seems in many ways to be more reasonable than human thinking, because we are dealing now with something totally apart from the attitudes of human beings. In the distribution of the Atlantic continent, as in the idealistic reconstructions thereof, we also observe what might be termed the eastern end of the Atlantic bridge. This eastern end seemingly extended reasonably to the north, certainly including much of England, and perhaps further into the Scandinavian area. Whether this was a continuous area, or whether there were islands and a land bridge at the northern end, we do not know. But Atlantis seems to have been bound to Europe at one time along the entire coast from what we now call the Scandinavian countries to the western point of Africa. It united with what is now Spain and Portugal. It united with the western coast of France. It extended upward into the Baltic countries. It was one tremendous band of land. And when we study the old maps and compare them with existing maps, the land bridges necessary to complete the picture would create a land area in the Atlantic Ocean basin about 1.5 times the size of the United States of America. It would have been a tremendous piece of land, a very vast area, with the Azores Islands somewhat above the center of the land, but within the general area thereof. On the western side, this tremendous continent was bound to the western hemisphere from an area north of Nova Scotia, up around Newfoundland, all the way down to what we will call Cape Hatteras. It then seems to have broken away and to have tipped with water between it and land, downward to include most of the West Indies. We do not find absolute proof of a land bridge as far south as the eastern points of South America. But we do have this tremendous area. How can we strive to increase our rational understanding of the effect of this culture upon surviving land areas? Let us therefore for the moment consider what seems to be a reasonable probability, namely that an attempt to escape from Atlantis, presuming that this continent was in the process of breaking up, would have been in the form of migrations over whatever land areas were available, or in narrow water areas which could be crossed by boats, rafts, or any available materials. We are not at all certain that long-range preparations for such navigation could be made. On the other hand, ships may also have been available, or large canoes of something of that nature. It would seem, though, that taking the Azores to be approximately the seat of the central point of Atlantean culture, though not the center of the continent, it would seem reasonable that those existing areas of the Earth's surface which were associated with the terminals of the ancient continent would be most likely to have direct relics or indications of the earlier connections. We have, however, an entirely different problem also to face, and that is our geological problem. According to our problem today, as we visualize it, a large part of the Atlantis story should have existed about the time of the Cro-Magnon, should have existed in the great periods which we recognize geologically as those related to the emergence or appearance of primitive man upon the earth. So we study the Cro-Magnon, we study the remnants of his way of life, and such as we are able to discover about him does not give us any distinct clue to our Atlantean culture. And here we must pause and give careful consideration to what might be termed negative evidence. We have no evidence that we can bring forth today out of the remnants and ruins of the past to indicate the primitive man of the Cro-Magnon period, at which period certainly Atlantis should have been there, already an existing culture, that the Cro-Magnon was equipped with any of the instruments of culture or civilization with which we associate the Atlantean. We have two answers possible to this dilemma. First is that the Cro-Magnon represented a level of primitive savagery which existed contemporaneously with a higher culture. Just as today, we would not be entirely flattered if our culture was to be estimated only by the Australian Bushman. Yet he exists today. He exists in a world which he is rather out of step with. And if in some remote time, archaeologists should excavate his remains in an effort to determine the cultural strata of the 20th century, ethnologist or anthropologist would come under a bad time. He would come to some very false conclusions. Thus, it is not as certain that the discovery of primitive man's remains invalidates the possibility of a higher culture existing at the same time, especially if this culture was somewhat limited from the standpoint of the area in which it developed. Plato's account cannot be dismissed with complete lightness, although again, it is only fair to say that as early as the 2nd and 3rd century, Platonists regarded it with suspicion. It should only, however, lead us to a more thorough and careful examination of such evidence as can be accumulated. We study the Cro-Magnon, we see his primitive struggle for existence. We see him fighting the mysteries of a prehistoric world which seems to have been abandoned to savagery and wildness. We find him groping upward for fire, for shelter, for clothing. We see very little indication in his struggle of the type of culture we are seeking. Does this mean that already land areas had broken away so that by degrees the Atlantic continent had shrunk into one vast insular region which was not in contact or indirectly accessible to the migrations of the primitive men of that time? Let us take a parallel of this and see how reasonable we are. In the year 1490, the Western Hemisphere, as we know it today, was comparatively unknown to a highly civilized people. In 1490, European man was not aware of the existence of the American Indian. He was not aware that between Europe and Asia was a vast continent that would someday dominate the world. Let us be a little more local in our thinking. Down in Central America, your Aztec, Maya, Toltec culture had practically no awareness whatever of the Plains Indians of North America. These nomadic tribes also seemingly, for the most part, derived very little from comparative proximity with the Aztec, Maya, Toltec cultures. The only point where they seemed to meet and mingle was along the banks of what we call today the Rio Grande. In other words, your New Mexican Pueblos, your town-dweller Indians, your Hopis, Zunis, are the ones which show the mingling of these two cultures. But not far away, other Indian tribes seem to be comparatively unaware that a great, highly cultured civilization lay to the south. The Empire of Montezuma was one of the greatest empires the world has ever known. Yet Montezuma knew nothing of the existence of Europe. Therefore, as late as the 15th century of the present era, one-third of the world was unknown to the balance, with a few exceptions, a few individuals who had had one or other way of greater contact. But these very individuals were ridiculed for their belief that such a thing could exist. Our American Indian is the victim of this misunderstanding, for the early explorers named him the Indian because they thought he was an East Indian and that they had reached Asia. Now, if this could happen in a civilization that could give us the greatness of Florence and Rome, the magnificent temples and palaces of the Near East, how much more so could this have occurred thousands, perhaps 50,000 years ago? Thus, the fact that areas were not commonly known and that various levels of culture, or lack of it, could have existed contemporaneously is not disproved. We therefore have certain negative findings, but they are not conclusive in any way. They only indicate, perhaps, that, as has been generally suspected, the Atlantic catastrophe took place over a very long period of change during most of the Pleistocene Age. That therefore, by the time that what we call the Cro-Magnon had made its appearance, some of the land bridges had already disappeared. And the primitive man of Europe had no means of reaching this larger world outside, or this tremendous complex of culture located upon its 10 islands, or upon its continents and islands. This will fit also, to a large degree, into our previous concept, namely that certain cultural motions from Atlantis may have rescued the Cro-Magnon and have started him on a way to culture, for which we have at this time no adequate explanation. What happened between the Cro-Magnon and the rise of Egypt? Here is an absolute blank. We have a man crawling around, fighting saber-toothed tigers. We have him living in a cave, mumbling raw bones. We have him struggling to perfect the stone axe. We find him scratching in unintelligible glyphs upon rock and fishing with bone fishhooks. We have him striving for fire and finally attaining it, and his principal instrument of defense being a rock, which he apparently tossed with some success at monsters that have since disappeared. We are not sure, however, that he was responsible for their disappearance. He probably missed most of his targets. Then in a short time, we find the rise of the first dynasties of Egypt. We find a literate people, a scientifically cultured people. We know nothing about what any man was doing 10,000 years ago. But 7,000 years ago, he was building pyramids. What happened between? What suddenly moved this mysterious missing link of Gabriel Max into what we call the pattern of progress? Something must have happened to him. Yet we have no record of what did happen to him.
He, in his surviving forms, primitive peoples of today have no adequate record except the myths which we have already discussed. Yet something definitely did happen. Whatever it was, gradually moved man with incredible rapidity from savagery to a socialized state, which already was admirable when history as we know it begins. The great Assyriologists, the great Egyptologists, the great Sinologists, none of them have any answer. They do not know what the force was that tipped man into a state of rational existence. This mystery perhaps is concealed in the biblical account of where the Adamus, or the pre-Adamite man, was suddenly endowed with soul, became a living soul, capable of thought, capable of conscious growth. The circumstances are dim. But if we are not willing to accept that primitive man had some teacher, then we must assume that for reasons totally inexplicable, the drive to intellectual attainment broke out all over the earth at a comparatively similar, if not identical, time, and that this drive suddenly lifted these primordial people into a state of intellectual attainment. We look around us and we observe with great interest the rise of peoples, the attainment of intellectual individuality under the existing conditions of today. True, we do not have as many primitive groups to work with. But we observe, for example, that within the last 10 years, a great change has taken place in the map of Africa. 10 years ago, we had only 3 sovereignties in Africa. These were Egypt, the little Negro Republic of Liberia, and the Empire of Ethiopia. All the rest of this vast continent was a colonial empire of foreign powers. Today, or very recently, in the newly liberated state of Ghana, which was previously the crown colony of the Gold Coast, 8 independent sovereignties of Africa met in national conference. There are now 8 independent nations in Africa. These independent nations reflect progress, but this progress was a gradual growth through contact. We may assume that had there been no contact between Africa and other groups of culture, contact which perhaps later became a burden under the colonial policies of various European powers, but certainly the original contact and its results in the terms of schools, sanitation, the development of communications with the outside world, missionaries, many other contributions, these made possible the rise of the independent states of Africa. What happened back in the days of our mysterious Cro-Magnon? Had he been reached by other powers who had advanced longer and considerably in the way of independent individualism, he might well be rapidly moved to a higher social foundation. But left completely to his own devices, we do not know exactly what it was that inspired the Cro-Magnon man to suddenly emerge in the rise of the greatest classic civilizations that we know, civilizations so glorious that they are still romances of fiction in our minds. We observe, in memory at least, the grandeur of Babylonia, the magnificent Ur of the Chaldees. We see the rise of great cities. We behold the wonders of Philae, at Karnak, at Luxor, and the tremendous pyramids upon the delta of the Nile. We see the rising glory of China and India. These things did not emerge suddenly out of the promagnon. Something had to happen. He did not have a long enough time, and more interesting. Had he developed these things of his own accord and in his own simple way, we would have, locked in the earth, locked in the stratas of geological formation and in the human artifacts, the unbroken record of these changes over long thousands of years. We do not have them. We do not have the evidence of the super Cro-Magnon. We do not have the indication of this man suddenly becoming the astronomer, the scientist, the physician. We do not find rising in him the vestiges of great theocratic states, the rise of knowledge. We do not find in him the seeds of reading, writing, and arithmetic. What happened? Until all these questions are satisfactorily answered, in some way, we have a right from a reasonable point of view to ask the questions. And we also have a right to advance as reasonable, but not factual, such explanations as may contribute most directly to the clarification of this difficulty. There seems to be only one possible answer. That is, natural answer. If we do not wish to ascend into the entirely rarefied atmosphere of mystical speculation, the most common reasonable answers are usually the correct ones and the last to be found. And these speculations would indicate that a wise young man who grew up alone and became a scholar must have known someone who was. Must have had at least sufficient contact to awaken within himself the realization of the possible directing of his own abilities. He might not have studied long with a scholar, but had he seen somewhere a state superior to his own, then he might gradually, through meditation, strive to attain it, having visualized it, having known of its existence. But without even the possibility of such awareness, it is unlikely that he would move very rapidly. And it is very interesting to note that the story of man's rise on this planet, as far as it is recorded, is phenomenally rapid. And that much that we can hardly understand or appreciate took place within a few thousand years, whereas other processes in nature took millions of years. Thus, the possibility of the existence of the hen before the appearance of the egg comes to our thinking. We, of course, can fall into Aristotle's problem of regressive evasion, because that previous hen requires a previous egg, which in turn supposes a previous hen, and we can go back beyond any point we wish to even imagine. The natural answer is, however, that somewhere man did have a period of growth sufficiently long to explain in terms of evolution his gradual attainments and his reasonable growth from infancy to maturity as a creature. And that this particular pattern of growth has disappeared so that we are no longer able to rescue its proportions. We can see only certain effects of it, but its own substantial nature completely eludes us. Atlantis offers a possibility, and it is also quite certain, as we have said before, that Atlantis represented a period, an epoch, in the development of world cultures. General Furlong, in his Rivers of Light, attempts to show the rise of the great cultures of mankind, particularly as these refer to the seven principal streams of religion. Looking over his long and intricate graphs relating to this procedure, we observe that the general is in exactly the same dilemma. He suddenly discovers in the background of things the altars of the seven great gods, or the seven great ideas, which later arose and developed and became systems of theology, which by their minglings produced philosophy, and these minglings with religion finally resulted in the emergence of science.
General Furlong then takes them back, so far. Then his charts dwindle out. And in his work, he is unable to identify the origin of one of the seven streams with which he is concerned. They suddenly flow from hidden sources. Once they appear, they are the wonder of the ages. But where were they before they appeared? For in the intervals involved, there is no time for their maturing. On one side of this dark curtain of history, a primitive man, unlettered, unlearned. He steps through the curtain like the prologue of a Shakespearean play. Behind the curtain, he is a savage. He steps through, takes a bow, he is a gentleman. How did it happen? It is not wise to assume merely magic. It is much wiser to assume that something happened which we do not know. Paracelsus said a miracle is only an effect, the cause of which is unknown, but the cause must be equal to its effect. And what produced civilized man must be equal to what it produced. This we do not know. We have no way of estimating. So we circle a little bit around the European end of this great bridge to find out, if we can, what was happening. One of the things that strikes us, as O'Brien points out in his Round Towers of Ireland, is a remain of ancient masonry in the Emerald Isle. These strange towers that look almost like Egyptian obelisks, except that they are circular. These towers belong to a kind of architecture which today is tied into the most elaborate folklore and legendary among a people who have become synonymous with folklore and legendary. The builders of the Round Towers of Ireland, O'Brien opines, might have been Buddhist monks. For there is a record that Buddhist monks from Asia reached Ireland at a remote period. Lord Kingsborough, in his great work, The Anacalypsis, also takes it for granted that Asiatic migrants reached Ireland at a very ancient time. How long ago? We do not know. And as we mentioned earlier, the various schools of archaeology are in no common accord as to the primitive remains in Ireland and in the north of Scotland. Another interesting group presents itself to us on the plains of England, where we have the strange mass of stones which we call Stonehenge. This is called a Druid temple, and we've heard it until we have come to believe it. Actually, the Druid remains and records, as preserved in the Welsh records and legends, and in the account of Taliesin, and even in the reports of Caesar, the Druids at that time used Stonehenge because they regarded it as a monument created by the gods of previous ages. The Druid records tell us definitely that the Druids found Stonehenge. They did not create it. They are much like your Aztecs of Mexico, who found the pyramids of the sun and moon, but did not build them. Stone used in the quarrying of the rocks of Stonehenge has been also a subject of great discussion. Some say that it was precipitated through the air by spirits. Well, that is helpful. And we are reminded of the historian Herodotus, who tells us that the builders of the pyramid started to build at the top and work down. This also gives us a moment of consideration. We also have read recently that it was advanced as a speculation to explain the mysterious figures and heads on Easter Island, as it is now called,
were moved by having huge stones quarried out, dropped into a volcano, which fired them out again and dropped them in convenient spots. This sounds a little too much on the order of modern rocket propulsion. Actually, all of these mysteries are mysterious for one reason only, and that is we cannot conceive of primitive man having the brains to do any of these things in a reasonable way. We are convinced that our primordial ancestors could do nothing better than throw rocks around, and small ones at that. That they were so concerned trying to find fire that they never got any further. Actually, a more interesting group even than Stonehenge is to be found in Brittany, in the western part of France. It is called Karnak, but it is not spelled the same as the Karnak in Egypt. Karnak is a mystic maze of stones, some of which would dwarf those of Stonehenge. But instead of a circle of stones, we have hundreds of them. Great monolithic rocks standing on end, forming rows like soldiers at attention. Why they were put there? Who put them there? No one knows. But one of our more factual friends decided that at a remote time, some native king or prince decided to hide a buried treasure. He hid it under one of the rocks and put all the others there to confuse people who were looking for it. Now, this is good, sober, factual stuff. And pretty ridiculous. These stones that were used in the building of Karnak will weigh up to 15 and 18 tons. They were moved, some of them considerable distances. And like the tremendous carved stones of Guatemala, they apparently were tipped into the ground at one end by digging a pit and allowing the weight of the stone to gradually drop it into the pit. After that, the opposite end was raised and the part in the pit was buried and became the foundation. This happened at Easter Island, we know. It was primitive engineering, but it was successful. But what caused it? What would lead a vast number of persons, that must have been a vast number, to devote an incredible period of time to raise a maze of rocks into the air, 12, 15, 18, 20 feet, leave them without a carving or a sculpturing upon them? And if that isn't mysterious enough, we can look around through England, Scotland, and Wales and find all kinds of large rocks that have been balanced like the head of a mushroom on a very small stem-like rock, so perfectly that they have balanced for ages. Why? No one knows. Yet most of these tasks, though primitive, seem to bear witness to a high resolution and purpose. This purpose we get no trace of in the story of the Cro-Magnon man. We find this problem, or this purpose, already exhausted by the time that Egypt began. But there is this similarity. The builders of the pyramids and the great monuments of Egypt used the same basic method, but they had highly refined it so that their achievements were orderly, scientifically reasonable. Somewhere, factors had come in, yet these factors were not unknown to the builders of Stonehenge and Karnak. The Druids found that Stonehenge constituted a magnificent calendar of the equinoxes and solstices. We know that the pyramid is oriented to the 11th decimal point. It is almost certain that the great ruins of Karnak in Brittany had some definite scientific or religious usage. These were built by persons who already knew something. They were not built by the Cro-Magnon, but apparently they were standing there long before we come to this dark curtain which divides prehistory from history as we know it now. We also observe a number of other intriguing and stimulating lines of thought. Where it is possible to trace the physical remains of a people, we have certain foundations upon which to build. When, however, we begin to trace the psychological foundations of people, we are in a field where our own instruments are inadequate. Psychology as we know it today is only 50 or 60 years old. We are seeking now for further insight into the pressures and archetypal patterns behind the human race. We are looking essentially for the same thing the scientist is trying to find out about the lemmings. We are trying to discover the source of the pressure which we have today called progress. What caused it? What has caused it to snowball? Why is it today that progress has gradually become mostly pressure? And that under the insistences of this tremendous momentum, we are sometimes afraid that we are rolling and rumbling our way towards some incalculable doom, that we are committing suicide just as the lemmings commit suicide each time they migrate along the field or line of their own tremendous pressure. This pressure seems to always be present as a result of a cause. We may like to assume that man's pressure began totally within himself. But every experience that we know tells us that there must be two kinds of pressure. One is pressure from within, and the other is pressure from the outside. That from one type, the first pressure, we discover the existence of energy resources, of power, and of will. We discover that under stimulation, under incentive, as we call it, man has an incredible reservoir of potential. But that this potential is only released when necessary, when conditions demand it, require it. And it prefers to be released sequentially, each step leading naturally to that which follows it. Just as the growth of the child is a sequential, regular procedure, so the growth of archetypal idea in man has been always a sequential growth. The battleship did not come first and the hollowed-out log afterwards. But from the hollowed-out log, man gradually learned one useful improvement after another until he was able to build a boat. But he only built the first boat, or hollowed out the log, because he discovered in certain areas that if he sat astride a log that was not hollow and allowed his feet to dangle in the water on both sides when he wanted to cross a stream, he was liable to lose a foot or two to a crocodile getting across. He found it necessary to protect himself against the dangers in the water. Therefore, he gained the idea of gradually lifting his feet out of the water and finding a place for them either on or in the log. And out of that gradually has come a procedure which has led to such great ships as we have today. Ships that are the inevitable development of sequential pressure within the incentive and inventive faculty of man. Therefore, the Egyptians, or the earliest culture groups in the Valley of the Euphrates, India, and China, that emerged with powerful cultural patterns, emerged because of incentive and because of a long period of experimentation. Now we look back upon them and we say, but after all, they may not have needed this period, because actually so many of their achievements were simple in comparison to ours. We needed their foundations, but they could never have conceived the things we would build upon them. There is one point of difference, however. When you educate a child, the most important, necessary, and difficult part is the first 2 or 3 years. There he must gain use of the instruments of his own education. He must be given the basic principles, reading, writing, arithmetic, spelling. He must have these things, for without these he cannot build. And now today, in the 20th century, we are not certain how these should be imparted to him. We are beginning to suspect that our methods of teaching him are not what they should be. Therefore, primarily, the great basic discoveries required the most enormous pressure of all, required the most powerful incentive, and some kind of judgment upon incentive, by means of which the early course of knowledge could have been clarified. We can send any child to school today, but only because there are 7,000 years of educational formula behind us. How we sent the first man to school, we do not know. Even presuming that he had the potential, only experience, discipline, repetition, and the orderly development of his faculties could have enabled him to make this tremendous transition within a conceivable period of time. And we have a very limited time in which he did it. And we know that we are not far off in the dating of this time. We can only assume, therefore, that what we call today the growth of man from the Pliocene, from perhaps the Pithecanthropus erectus, or the Neanderthal man, or the Heidelberg man, these ancient ape-like humans, these could not be all that preceded the rise of Egypt, the glory of China, the magnificence of India, and the splendor of the Greco-Roman culture. It's just not conceivable. So we have to have something. And these incentives have to come to us from some disciplined cause or source. Nearly all your ancient mythologies attempt to explain this by stating that there were upon the earth in ancient times superior races of beings. And in religion, we find them everywhere. We find them in Ireland. We find them in Scotland. We find records of them in France and England. Everywhere we search, as in the case of the sagas and the Eddas, in the case of the ancient Arabian records, the Egyptian legends, always we have a people that arose from previous contact with culture. The only difference between this viewpoint and that of the Atlantic research student is the effort to determine the estate and stature of these previous teachers. Donnelly was one of the first to present the possibility that these ancient teachers were the highly developed people of previous races. He opposes to this the presumption that these were angelic beings, creatures of a superior order of life.